The big daddy of Asian American hate crimes, the Vincent Chin case, 35 years later, observations from a person who was there when the fight for justice began, and Ronald Evans apologized for the murder to me in 2012. Is Vincent Chin's killer's apology sincere enough? That's next on A Meal Amongst Takeout. Hi, everyone, and welcome to what I call A Meal Amongst Takeout. We serve it, you take it out. Forms the acronym EAT, E-A-T, and it is time to eat. My takes on all things about race, society, politics, and diversity, and everything those things touch in our culture and society with respect to Asian Americans. And you don't have to be Asian American to lend us your ears. We give them back, besides. It's your minds we want. That's right. I'm Emil Guillermo, your host, and you might say, why amok? Well, the short story is that for nearly 15 years, my Emil Amok column was a staple of Asian Week, what was once the leading Asian American weekly in English in America. Amok was the name of my compilation of essays, and amok is also on my driver's license, not indicative of my mental state. And it's also the name of my solo show, the one-man show that I'm premiering at the San Diego International Fringe Festival, June 23rd through 28th. The time is approaching, and if you're interested in going to the show, check out my website at www.amok.com. There's a link to get tickets. There's information on the show, June 23rd through 28th. It's at Horton Plaza down there in that downtown San Diego area. So do come by, check it out, and I don't know if you have a hardship case and say, look, Emil, I'd like to get tickets. Maybe you got a freebie for me. Send me an email. I'd be maybe happy if you have a good story to get you in. But really, tickets are inexpensive. I think there's something like 10 bucks or something like that. And it's a nice, small, intimate theater. It's a San Diego International Fringe Festival. I'll be at the San Diego Art Institute pop-up space at Horton Plaza. I look forward to seeing you June 23rd through 28th. Now, Amok is also the column that I write that's home-based now on the website of the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund. That's at ALDEF, ALDEF.org/blog. Check it out. If you like what you see and what you hear, ALDEF is a 501c3. Go to the donate button. It's tax deductible. And, it's not a bad way to get a tax cut. I mean, not like this draconian Trump way. I mean, it's a tax deductible donation to a legit 501c3 at aldef.org. Now, on this episode, we focus on the Vincent Chin case with a special interview with Chin estate trustee Helen Zia. And we look at the apology Chin's killer gave me back in 2012. But we begin 35 years after the Chin murder with these essential Asian American facts. On June 19, 1982, Chinese American Vincent Chin, 27, was with friends at his own bachelor party, was mistaken for a Japanese person by two white auto workers, Ronald Evans and his stepson Michael Nitz, at a Detroit strip club. Now, to American auto workers, an Asian was symbolic of the global competition that their industry faced. Evans told me Chin sucker punched him. The fight was taken outside, but then broken up. It would have ended, but Evans and Nitz pursued Chin by car and found him at a nearby McDonald's. In the parking lot, Evans beat Chin senselessly with a baseball bat. Chin was comatose for 4 days and pronounced dead on June 23rd. For all that, Evans and Nitz, his accomplice, were allowed to plea bargain. They pled guilty to second-degree murder, given 3 years probation, and fined $3,720. Once again, for the murder of Vincent Chin, there was no prison time. The community was outraged, and a federal prosecution on civil rights charges was filed. Evans was found guilty and given a 25-year sentence. But Evans appealed to the Sixth Court, and a second federal trial was moved from Detroit to Cincinnati. And that's where Evans was acquitted. And that's where the story's been for the last 35 years. The perps are free, and Asian Americans can still be subjected to extremely violent hate crimes, like Srinivas Kuchibhotla, an Asian American mistaken for a Muslim. This year, in Olathe, Kansas, Kuchibhotla was allegedly killed by a white gunman who yelled, "Get out of my country." For the 35th year marker of Chin's death, I called the writer Helen Zia, who is also the trustee of the Chin estate, to get an update. Zia said the Chin family was awarded a $2 million judgment in civil litigation against Ebens back in the 80s and continues to monitor Ebens, now 77 and retired in Nevada. The judgment has been continued, Zia told me, though there's no running count. With interest and penalties, she said it could be in excess of $8 million. She said Ebens has, quote, not paid a dime. Zia said she's philosophical about any recovery. The guy did what he did, she told me. He's a killer. He got away with murder. But the things that need to be done on behalf of the community don't depend on him or his death. It will bring closure, but it doesn't mean hate crimes have ended. Besides being the trustee of the estate, Zia was right there in the thick of the Chin case in Detroit. A journalist with legal training, she wrote for the daily newspaper there, but refrained from writing about the case so she could be one of the founders of the American Citizens for Justice, the group formed to fight for Chin. It was just a handful of Asian American lawyers and activists. At that time, there were few Asian Americans in the law or in journalism, and there was no one with the expertise to do a federal hate crime case. 35 years later, Zia said what strikes her the most are the things people don't bring up about the case. The human stuff, like the late Lily Chin, Vincent's adoptive mom. She died feeling that if she hadn't adopted him, he'd be alive, Zia told me. It's so sad to me to think about it that way. But the human stuff also includes the human opposition to the case within the community and the backlash that existed then. We had civil rights people who said, we'll support you because Vincent was Chinese and thought to be Japanese. But if he were Japanese, we won't support because he would have deserved it, Zia said. I said, what? You kidding? The Michigan ACLU and the Michigan National Lawyers Guild strongly opposed a civil rights investigation because Asian Americans are not protected by federal civil rights law. That was something we had to argue. Fortunately, the national organizations of those legal groups prevailed and forced the state chapters to comply. Here were some of the most liberal activists, attorneys, saying Asian Americans shouldn't be included under the civil rights law. Vincent was an immigrant. We had to establish he was a citizen with the implication there might not have been a civil rights investigation if he had not been naturalized. All this stuff, these were hurdles we had to overcome with major impacts today, Zia told me. Can you imagine if the Reagan White House had followed the National Lawyers Guild Michigan chapter and the ACLU's Michigan chapter and said, why should we look expansively at civil rights? We shouldn't include immigrants and Asian Americans. And at that time, that would include Latinos too, because at that time, if you were not black or white, at that point, what do you have to do with race? Those are the things people would say to us. Zia said after 35 years, a quick telling of the Chin case rarely discusses just how difficult it was to fight for justice. But she says those are the enduring lessons of the Vincent Chin case, because it's contributed to a modern sense of social justice for every Asian American. Every immigrant, Latinos, every American, Zia said. Hate crime protection laws now also include perceived gender disability. It was the Vincent Chin case when we had to argue civil rights was more than black or white. Zia said the case was also more difficult because it was during a pre-digital, non-computer payphone age. Communication occurred slowly. But the case was also slow because Asian Americans were still a micro-community. We're 21 million now and feel somewhat empowered. In 1980, Asian Americans were just 3.7 million people, and most were timid, non-boat rockers. In the Vincent Chin case, people were incredibly reluctant to become involved, Zia told me. They had never gotten involved before, and I think that's what gets lost in the retelling of the story. Exclusion didn't end until about 1950, and so what that meant was Asian Americans of every kind, from Chinese to Filipinos, everybody, were pretty much totally disenfranchised till the mid-20th century. So when Vincent Chin was killed 30 years later, in 1982, the communities had, I think of it as stunted growth. There weren't people running for office. If there were, it was a minuscule number. There weren't people standing up. We didn't have advocacy organizations. A right to justice and a community sense of empowerment was a difficult thing to imagine for many Asian Americans. Not only did we not have it, Zia said, people didn't even recognize it was something we could have. The idea we all came together with the Vincent Chin case and sang Kumbaya and took over and went to the Reagan White House and the Department of Justice and get all these things to happen, that's a mythology. And I think it's a disservice to the next generations to think this. Helen Zia knows what was happening in Detroit in the 80s as a fight began for Vincent Chin. More of her observations on the case 35 years later. You know, we've talked about this a long time. How do you feel coming up to the 35th anniversary? Is this a special one, or is it a critical one in your mind, considering where we are now in this, you know, at this stage in our country, and where we are with race relations? How do you see the 35th?
Well, I have a lot of feelings about the 35th. I don't even like saying anniversary, but 35 years after Vincent Chin was killed in a hate crime. If Vincent were alive today, he'd be 62 years old, which is what I think about a life taken, and not just his life, but his mother, Mrs. Lily Chin, who I became very close to. I mean, you know, the one thing she wanted, the one thing she cared about was family. Her only child who was adopted, and that she died feeling that if she hadn't adopted him, he would still be alive. I mean, it's so sad to me to think about it that way. But also, I think about all of the efforts that were made to get justice for Vincent Chin, and that he did not die in vain, in the sense that so many organizations were created to bring people together, Asian Americans together in a pan-Asian way, and to have advocacy and to talk about race and civic involvement, joining together with other communities of color and people of conscience of every denomination, really, across religions. Detroit also has the largest Arab American community in the, you know, outside of the Middle East. And when Vincent Chin was killed, we also joined together with, you know, African American, Arab American, Jewish American groups, and many more. And so it was a time of coming together in unity to fight injustice. And 35 years later, I think we are in a much more divisive state. And it is critical. The kind of hate-mongering and division and the celebration of having white supremacists and neo-Nazis in the White House is terrifying. And that's celebrated across the world and giving power to all who want to hold on to what white power means, or a nativist power. And it bothers me that these organizations, these active organizations, are being fueled by what's going on. They're celebrating it, and they call it populist. There's nothing populist about it. These are angry, privileged minority groups, you know, and in the U.S., in California, they're already a minority. In 10 states in the United States, they are a minority. And what I think we're seeing today is the recognition that the U.S. is becoming much more diverse in color. People who have been on the margins in all ways, including lesbian, gay, LGBT, queer people, you know, women, issues of gender, disability, people of color, and this drives those who wish for an America that existed 300 or 400 years ago, those who wish for that, it drives them crazy to know that they are becoming in the minority, and America will soon put them completely in the minority. And so, yes, to your question, is this 35th anniversary in this time and this place and where the world and this country is at? Yes, it's very important, I think. hate crimes are just beyond count, actually. We don't even know, because now we have an administration that doesn't even want to count them, doesn't want to do anything about them. Not only that, foments hate and division, and so threatens people, threatens to send them back to regimes where they'll be killed. I mean, it's really, in my mind, we're not in a good place. And so we need to take the lessons from the Vincent Chin case and beyond that, Black Lives Matter, all of the civil rights movement, the women's liberation, the LGBT movement, and many of the things that were advanced under the Barack Obama administration. We need to pull those together and swing the pendulum back, and we will, because the arc of history bends toward justice if we make it bend.
You know, Helen, it's been said that when the Chin case came up, that it galvanized the community, it awakened Asian Americans to activism. It really did something a generation ago. Does it have the same kind of power still to this day? Because there's new generations of people who are just discovering Vincent Chin for the first time, many of them.
To your question about whether the Vincent Chin case has the power it had then, I mean, it was 35 years ago. It was a different time. The main thing is that we remember it and remember the lessons of it. Some newer generations look at the Vincent Chin case, or they look at the civil rights movement, or they look at the anti-war movements of the 1960s and think, wow, people really came together then. Why can't we duplicate that today? And there's a tendency to look at it nostalgically, to mythologize that it all came together so magically and it was a different time. It wasn't. You know, there were many casualties of all of those movements, and then the Vincent Chin case did not come together easily. So there are a lot of lessons to learn that are not just about people coming together, but what it took to bring people together. And those are lessons that are timeless. Does it have the same energy as it did back then? Well, it is a different time. And so in Detroit, there were so few Asian Americans in Detroit back in the 1980s and before, that there was no question that if one Asian American ethnic group needed to rise up and speak out, that everybody did, that we needed to join together because we were way too small to accomplish a national civil rights investigation and trial ourselves. And not only that, that we needed to join together with anybody who would join to us in the quest for justice. And that included, you know, in Detroit, African-Americans, Anglo-Americans who were people of conscience, who supported the notion that people should be able to live in dignity and not be killed because of how they look. And so, but that recognition even still took effort. Today, there are so many, you know, talking about the increasing numbers of people of color, of different multicultural groups, I think lends maybe newer generations to think that somebody else will take care of it. There's so many other people. There's so many other Chinese. Some other Chinese will take care of it. I don't need to stand up as a Chinese American. Now there are organizations. Back then, there were no organizations, advocacy organizations for Asian Americans. And so if we wanted that, we would have to form them. Now they exist. And the larger numbers, more than 20 million Asian Americans today, I think it would be an easy illusion to have to say, well, I can stick my head in the sand and pretend nothing's going on and just enjoy myself because somebody else will take care of it. Well, one of the lessons of the Vincent Chin case is if you want to see change, you have to speak up yourself. You have to step up in some way. And that doesn't have to be dedicating your life to being an activist. All it means is you need to pay attention. And when the time comes to vote, to send an email to your member of Congress, to, you know, donate small change if you can, or more if you're that fortunate, to show up at a protest, to get involved. I mean, that is one of the lessons of the Vincent Chin case. And so we need to repeat it over and over again, and the fact that people are even remembering that 35 years ago, a 27-year-old bridegroom-to-be was killed just because he looked Japanese has a lot of resonance today when anybody who looks Muslim, which can be really anybody, but anybody who looks Muslim can be killed just because of how they look. Or hate crimes because anybody who looks like they might be gay, you know, a child on a playground can be attacked. Those are all things that are very much, you know, out in the forefront today, and we really need to remember all of the lessons of the Vincent Chin case.
Helen Zia, a trustee of the Chin Estate, and one of the original members of American Citizens for Justice, who led the fight for justice for Vincent Chin. I don't know what Chin's killer did for Father's Day. I last talked to him in 2015, around the June 23rd anniversary of Chin's death. "I'm doing fine," he told me then, adding quickly he had a good Father's Day with his kids. I asked him then if he ever thought about the anniversary. "Like what?" he said. "I never forget it." "Never? Of course not." It was 2015. "I'm 75 years old and I'm just tired of all that after 33 years. He's 77 now, and Helen Zia doesn't want him to ever tire or forget the truth. He will never spend a day of his life without knowing he has a huge debt to society and a huge debt to Vincent Chin's family, Zia told me. And one day he will pay for it. The very first time I talked to Evans was in 2012, on the 30th anniversary of the Chin murder. In a second, I'll read the column aloud that I wrote on June 22, 2012. It has Evans explaining himself and describing what happened that night. He was reluctant to talk to me, but he did. And during our conversation, he apologized for the murder. "I'm sorry it happened, and if there's any way to undo it, I'd do it," he told me in my exclusive interview. "Nobody feels good about it. Somebody's life's been taken, okay? You just never get over it. Anybody who hurts somebody else, if you're a human being, you're sorry, you know?" But Zia, who has read my column, has never bought that as an apology. "I stood next to this guy in court, and I see his face over and over, read his words, and frankly, I don't see a shred of sincerity," Zia told me. He's really saying, "I didn't even mean to kill. Why should I have to go through this?" And then to me, Zia said, "It would take more than you interviewing him saying, 'I'm sorry I killed him.' Let's see how sorry he is and set an example for future people who are thinking of killing a Muslim student in North Carolina or a man in Kansas. These killers who kill out of hatred and go to justify their killings, it takes more than saying, 'I'm sorry.'" Here's my column I wrote after talking to Ronald Evans, June 22, 2012, during the 30th anniversary of the killing of Vincent Chin. After 30 years, the killer of Asian American icon Vincent Chin told me in an exclusive interview that the murder known as a hate crime wasn't about race, nor does he ever even remember hitting Chin with a baseball bat. Incredible as that sounds, there is one thing Ronald Evans is clear about. Evans, who was convicted of second-degree murder but spent no time in prison for the act, is sorry for the beating death of Vincent Chin on June 19, 1982, in Detroit, even though for many Asian Americans, he can't say sorry enough. For years, Evans has been allowed to live his life quietly as a free man. With the arrival of the 30th anniversary this month, and after writing about the case for years, I felt the need to hear Evans express his sorrow with my own ears so that I could put the case behind me. So I called him up, and he talked to me. On the phone, Evans, a retired auto worker, said killing Chin was the only wrong thing I ever done in my life. though he received probation and a fine and never served any time for the murder, Eben says he's prayed many times for forgiveness over the years. His contrition sounded genuine over the phone. "It's absolutely true. I'm sorry it happened. And if there's any way to undo it, I'd do it," said Ebens, who was then 72. "Nobody feels good about somebody's life being taken away, okay? You just never get over it. Anybody who hurts somebody else, if you're a human being, you're sorry, you know?" Ebens said he'd take back that night if he could, 1,000 times. And that after all these years, he can't put the memory out of his head. "Are you kidding? It changed my whole life," said Ebens. "It's something you never get rid of. When something like that happens, if you're any kind of person at all, you never get over it. Never." Ebens' life has indeed changed. As a consequence of the Chin murder, Ebens said he lost his job, his family, and has scraped by from one low-wage job to the next to make ends meet. Ultimately, he remarried and sought refuge in Nevada, where he's been retired 8 years, owns a home, and lives paycheck to paycheck on Social Security. His current living situation makes recovery of any part of the millions of dollars awarded to Chin's heirs in civil proceedings highly unlikely. The civil award with interest has grown to around $8 million. "It was ridiculous then, it's ridiculous now," Eben said with defiance. His life hasn't been easy the last 30 years, but at least he's alive. He watches a lot of TV, he said, like America's Got Talent. "They've got good judges," he said. Sort of like the judges he got in his case, like Judge Charles Kaufman, the Michigan judge who sentenced him to probation without notifying Chin's attorneys, virtually assuring Ebens would never serve time for the murder. Ebens didn't want to comment on that. For all the time he spends in front of the television, Eben said he has never seen either of the two documentaries that have been made on the case, and said he made a mistake speaking to one of the filmmakers. Even for this column, Eben showed his reluctance to be interviewed. But he finally consented to let me use all his statements because I told him I would be fair. I'm not interested in further demonizing Ronald Ebens. I just wanted to hear how he deals with being the killer of Vincent Chin. For 3 decades, the Chin case has been a driving force that has informed the passion among activists for Asian American civil rights. Some still feel there was no justice even after the long ordeal that included the state murder prosecution, where Ebens and his stepson Michael Nitz were allowed to plea bargain to second-degree murder, given 3 years probation and fined $3,720. The first federal prosecution on civil rights charges that ended in a 25-year sentence for Ebens. Or the subsequent appeal by Ebens in the Sixth Circuit, which was granted. Or the second federal trial that was moved from Detroit to Cincinnati and ended in Ebens' acquittal. Add it all up, and it seems a far cry from justice. One man dead, perps go free. I thought that maybe Ebens could help me understand how he got justice and not Vincent Chin. I asked him about his side of the story, which was a key dispute in the court testimony about how it all started at the Fancy Pants strip club. "It should never have happened," said Ebens, "and it has nothing to do with the auto industry or Asians or anything else. Never did, never will. I could have cared less about that. That's the biggest fallacy of the whole thing." That night at the club, after some harsh words were exchanged, Ebens said Chin stood up and came around to the other side of the stage. "He sucker punched me and knocked me off my chair. That's how it started. I didn't even know he was coming," Ebens said. Chin's friends testified that Ebens made racial remarks, mistaking Chin to be Japanese. And then when Chin got into a shoving match, Ebens threw a chair at him, but struck Nitz instead. But Ebens' version, that there was no racial animosity or epithets, is actually supported by testimony from Chin's friend Jimmy Choi, who apologized to Ebens for Chin's behavior that included Chin throwing a chair and injuring Nitz. Oh, what about the baseball bat and how Ebens and Nitz followed Chin to a nearby McDonald's? Ebens said, when all parties were asked to leave the strip club, they were out in the street. It's undisputed that Chin egged Ebens to fight on. "The first thing he said to me is, 'You want to fight some more?'" Ebens recalled. 5 against 2 is not good odds," said Ebens, who declined to fight. Then later, when Chin and his friends left, Ebens' stepson went to get a baseball bat from his car. Ironically, it was a Jackie Robinson model. even said he took it away from Nitz because he didn't want anyone taking it from him and using it on them. But then Eben said his anger got the best of him, and he drove with Nitz to find Chin, finally spotting him at the nearby McDonald's. "That's how it went down," Eben said. "If he hadn't sucker punched me in that bar, nothing would have ever happened. They forced the issue. And from there, after the anger built up, that's when things went to hell." Eben's called it, quote, "the gospel truth." But he says he's cautious speaking now because he doesn't want to be seen as shifting the blame. "I'm as much to blame," he sadly admitted. "I should have been smart enough to just call it a day. After they started to disperse, it was time to get in the car and go home." At the McDonald's, where the blow that led to Chin's death actually occurred, Eben's memory is more selective. To this day, he even wonders about hitting Chin with the bat. "I went over that 100, maybe 1,000 times in my mind the last 30 years. It doesn't make sense of any kind. That I would swing a bat at his head when my stepson is right behind him? That makes no sense at all." And then he quickly added, almost wistfully, "I don't know what happened." Another time in the interview, he admitted his memory may be deficient. That was really a traumatic thing, he told me about his testimony. "I hardly remember even being on the stand." He admitted that everyone had too much to drink that night, but he's not claiming innocence. "No," Eben said, "I took my shot in court. I pleaded guilty to what I did, regardless of how it occurred or whatever. A kid died, okay? And I feel bad about it. I still do." Eben's told me he has Asian friends where he lives, though he didn't indicate if he shares his past with them. When he thinks about Chin, he said no images come to mind. "It just makes me sick to my stomach, that's all," he said. "Thinking about all the lives that were wrecked, both Chin's and his own." By the end of our conversation, Eben still wasn't sure he wanted me to tell his story. "It'll only alienate people," he said. "Why bother? I just want to be left alone and live my life." But I told him I wouldn't judge. I would just listen, use his words. I told him it was important in the Asian American community's healing process to hear a little more from him than a one line, "I'm sorry." He ultimately agreed. "One line doesn't adequately explain another human being's feelings and actions," I told him. I told him I would paint a fuller picture. So now that we've heard what Ebens has to say 30 years later, I don't know from a phone conversation if he's telling me the truth, nor do I know if I'm ready to forgive him. But I heard from him, and now that I have, I can deal with how the justice system failed Vincent Chin and continue to help in the fight that it never happens again. Me reading from my column that I wrote after talking to Ronald Ebens, June 22nd, 2012. Ebens, the convicted murderer of Vincent Chin, saying he was sorry on the 30th anniversary of the killing of Vincent Chin. And that's our program. We're on iTunes, so please subscribe, rate, and review. Go to iTunes and get the show. Tell your friends about the show. Share a link with them. You can also contact me on Twitter at Emil Amok. That's E-M-I-L-A-M-O-K. Or go to the Aldef blog at www.aldef.org/blog. Give us your feedback at www.amok.com and leave a message there on SpeakPipe. You don't need a phone. And if you're so moved, check out the blog and support the program. Go to aldef.org/blog and click on the donate button. Aldef, the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund, is a 501c3, and your help is fully tax deductible. Just let them know you like the podcast and the blog. And that's it. Once again, thanks for listening to Emil Amok's Takeout, this special 35th anniversary of the killing of Vincent Chin. I'm Emil Guillermo.